Mr. Morris has been far too generous and far too kind. I shall not be generous. I was reminded of this. You probably all know that Lester Thurow's students referred to him as less than Thurow. As I drove through the landscape of southeastern Michigan, shaped and mounded by the last great glacier, I recalled that not so long ago, as history goes, these moraines and eskers, these lakes and dunes, were covered and created by hundreds of feet of ice, pressing down in a great shield over what we now call the Middle West. Michigan and Illinois were still a glacial landscape only 10,000 years ago. You will recall that illiterate humankind has occupied portions of Europe, Asia, and Africa for 5,000 years. Illiterate humankind. Or half that length of time between the Great Glacier and ourselves. From the standpoint of climate and geology, that is only yesterday. It is sometimes said, though it is certainly false, that we conservatives are resistant to change, that we, above all, believe in stasis, in a pervasive status quo. I wish to suggest to you that, in fact, given conservatism's sense of history, we know that change is inevitable and often desirable. What we believe is that values and principles are in the realm of the permanent things, and that these values must always be instantiated in the new historical context and given a form congruent with present needs. Stasis is a reactionary rather than a conservative value. Or should I say that in the current political situation, stasis is a liberal rather than a conservative value? I raise this interesting and vital question particularly with respect to the history of climate. And climate and change, the transformation of the environment, and the adaptation of nature to human purposes. These, of course, are not new questions, though the notion that stasis in nature and the preservation of the status quo in the climate are new, and these may be a powerful delusion with destructive consequences. The fact is that climate, as has been pointed out to you almost ad nauseum, that climate is always changing. Those of you who have read Times of Feast, Times of Famine, A History of Climate Change Since the Year 1000 by Emmanuel Ladurie, you know that this man, who is the current director of the Bibliothèque Nationale, has shown us that since the year 1000 in Europe, there have been great and sometimes catastrophic changes of climate and environment. These changes took place long before the widespread employment of fossil fuels. Paleoclimatology, reaching back into history long before the written record, establishes a fact of great global warmings and coolings wholly aside from man's transformation of the environment. Moreover, no one has been able to establish with any certainty the causes of these major shifts of climate. It all remains in the realm of hypothesis and supposition. It is invidious, or is it invidious, to suggest that there is a major science industry dependent upon research monies, and that funding is always a problem, and that their use of scare tactics has become an intrinsic part of the struggle for public and foundation monies. We were treated to such a show recently with the prediction of an asteroid collision with the Earth in the not-so-remote future. It is rather like, of course, predicting that there will be a winter day in January in Michigan. From the standpoint of political theory, stasis is not a sound or a genuine conservative value. From the standpoint of environmentalism, it is a delusion, but a delusion fraught with the most momentous consequences. How ought conservatives to view and participate in the debate concerning climate change and environmentalism? Conservatives, above all others, know how ambiguous in character change is. That something has changed for the better or the worse becomes clear only well after the change has taken place. One of the most important principles of all historical and political analysis is the principle of the unanticipated consequences of rational action. Beyond the effects of calculated action lie a host of derivative and related effects which may be both astonishing and disastrous in their consequences. The costs of intervention may be greater than the costs of non-intervention. Alas, historians usually approve the way things are and the devious and treacherous path by which we have arrived at the present. Hypothetical history of it might have been never seems to be very popular, either with historians or with politicians. As I drive across the Midwest in August and take pleasure in the bounty of corn and soybeans, which make these Midwestern states the granary of the world, I'm not dissolved in sorrow that the prairie sod was broken and that buffalo no longer roam across the present location of the village of Pleasant Plains. This ambiguity of ends and means, of the evaluation of change and the unanticipated consequences of rational action, forces a consideration of values and purposes in human action in relationship to nature. Are wolves in Idaho more desirable and important than lambs? Is the abysmal darter, a hitherto unknown minnow, more important than the construction of hydroelectric project, which will light a city and power an industry? During World War II, I was sent to New Guinea, where I encountered Papuan savages. It was apparent to me that this archaic culture was doomed. At that time, unsophisticated as I was, I felt that these poor, fear-ridden, dirty, scabby, illiterate creatures who had not yet made a connection between sexual intercourse and childbirth ought to be civilized, sent to school, taught hygiene, inducted into the rational processes of civilization.